Lord, grant us understanding, that your wisdom may dwell in us. Amen. It must be a mistake, I said to myself when I flicked through the readings set for today. A misprint, perhaps. It can't be right to have the story of the crucifixion on the Sunday before Advent. That's about 4 months too early. It's even worse than Christmas in the shops once Halloween is gone. So I checked, and there it was, in black and white, Good Friday at the end of November. Jeremiah, on the other hand, seemed more like it. Very apt for the middle of a general election campaign, when promises are so blithely made, even when they've been made before and not been carried out. The prophets he has such harsh words for were political as well as religious figures, not that such a distinction would have been made in those far-off times. Jeremiah is the best biblical example of a prophet who sees through fake news. Do not listen to the words of the prophets. They are deluding you. They speak visions of their own minds, not from the mouth of the Lord. At least ours don't claim to be God's spokespeople, which is some small comfort. But many of the issues we face, from the distribution of wealth to the care of an increasingly elderly population, from movements of population to global warming, require at heart a moral and spiritual vision if they are to be properly tackled, not the honeyed words of those who are anxious to grab power for 5 more years. In the midst of this institutionalized corruption, Jeremiah looks to the coming of a righteous king in the line of David, one who will deal wisely and execute justice in the land. Would that we could hope for a government both wise and just, or is that too much to expect from fallible humans? So a gospel reading which doesn't belong to the run-up to Christmas, and a prophet who doesn't mince his words about the moral failures of his own times and the terrible consequences which follow. Hard to see a connection. And my dilemma only increased when I read over the passage from Colossians. Here are a series of statements about Christ which are about as far removed from the man hanging on a cross in Luke as they could possibly be. Listen to them as you look at the crucified one. He is the image of the invisible God. Does that mean that God is a total failure? That God is dead, like this man who has paid the price for speaking truth to power? All things have been created through him and for him. But this forsaken soul? You must be joking. He's been put to death by powerful vested interests because his words and deeds were too uncomfortable and threatening to them. He has nothing. He is nothing. In him, all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him, God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things. How can it be? Even in St. Paul's extraordinary mind, that when we contemplate the crucifixion, we see a cosmic figure around whom everything else revolves and who is the key to building the world we dream of, in which people no longer maim and kill each other and earth itself is at peace. I mean, you expect me to believe that this poor, deluded man who has fallen foul of his own leaders and succumbed to Roman might, is our way to paradise? The gap between appearance and reality is never greater than on this day. We see an abject failure and are expected to recognize him as Christ the King. As if we were asked to look at a homeless person on the streets of Oxford and believe them to be the answer to all our woes. And do you know, as soon as I wrote those words, it occurred to me that yes, perhaps they are. If only we can look through the appearance to ask the uncomfortable questions of our own society and its values, which such sadly common sights embody. Then, while waiting for a hospital appointment with my mother, I found myself reading an article in one of the Sunday magazines about a truly courageous and great man who has spent many years giving medical care to the victims of rape in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Those of us who are old enough, which is probably most of us, will remember the bloodshed which followed when what had been the Belgian Congo gained independence in 1960. This is potentially one of the richest countries on earth. Its mineral wealth has become even more important as our technology has developed. Tantalum, tungsten, tin, gold, cobalt, coltan in our mobile phones and computers. People have been fighting the control of this wealth for decades, and the population has been terrorized and impoverished. Rape is not a new weapon of war. One of my mother's now deceased friends, a Prussian baroness, was repeatedly raped by Russian soldiers as they advanced into Germany at the end of the last war. The man I was reading about, Denis Mukwege, is known as Dr. Miracle. He's a gynecologist and also a Pentecostalist pastor who last year won the Nobel Peace Prize. He has been treating young children and babies who have been raped and has saved thousands of lives. The horror of it is beyond imagination. What kind of moral and spiritual compass does someone have who thinks it appropriate to rape anyone, let alone young children and babies? The thought that came to me was this. When we read of such atrocities, we cannot but think of their perpetrators as abusing their power over their weak and helpless victims. But we also find this complete inversion of moral value abhorrent. It shakes us to the core of our being that any human being could do such a thing. Do we not instinctively pass judgment on the offenders at the same time as we grieve for the suffering they have inflicted on the innocent? Do we not worry about the effects of such brutality on young lives, some of whom will not remember what has happened but will have been traumatized by it? And doesn't the work of one doctor and his team in a war-torn land help us to hear the other voice, give us the other side of the human story, the creative and hopeful one of risking one's own life to save the lives of others? Put like that, it is not so very far away from the crucifixion on the one hand and Paul's astonishing claim that this and not the brute force of Rome or the lies of the establishment, this alone has the power to repair what has been broken and tend our wounds. This last Sunday before Advent used to be known, perhaps it still is by some of you, as Stir Up Sunday, from the collect for the day in the prayer book. Stir up, we beseech thee, O Lord, the wills of thy faithful people. And apparently it helped people remember to stir up the ingredients of their Christmas puddings, which, though useful, is no doubt an unintended consequence of the words chosen by the compilers of the prayer book. More recently, it has become the Feast of Christ the King. And I don't know what the effect has been on Christmas puddings, but it could have been really serious. Now, as I've said, I have some difficulties with this because it can sound triumphalistic or be used to tell people that whatever they're going through now, at some unspecified time in the future, God will intervene to put it all right. Human kings have been a very mixed bunch, both in the Bible and in our own history. Oh, they sit on thrones, dispense favours and justice, rule their people with varying degrees of success, and that is an image of power. Kings are not poor Palestinian preachers who are arrested, tortured, and executed. When we look at the cross, we do not see the magnificence of state, but bloodshed and death. We do not see the image of power, only its victim. As far as anyone could tell, that was the end of Jesus of Nazareth, and that is what should have been the case, except that it wasn't. Otherwise, we would all be sitting at home, tutting about the state of the world and carrying on regardless. The cross is the culmination of the first act of the drama of Jesus Christ. As John's Gospel so movingly testifies, it is his throne, the place where he is lifted up, and it is also his glory, a glory woven of shame and degradation. The second act begins at dawn 2 days later, and it hasn't ended yet. It is still being performed, not least by Dr. Miracle, but also by all those whose lives have been touched by resurrection faith. It cannot be silenced by guns or prisons or threats or death, but it can be hard to hear its still small voice in all the noise which surrounds us. Harder still to see it in the wounded places of our earth. Paul knew perfectly well that the Christ of whom he writes in such universal terms had been betrayed by a friend, was tortured, and had breathed his last on a cross. But he also saw beneath the appearance to a reality which first met him unexpectedly and forcefully on the road to Damascus. "Why do you persecute me?" the voice had said. It is the same question that is asked so powerfully by every victim of human hatred and violence. Why are you doing this? And in the confusion which followed, Paul began to see, slowly and painfully, that all the energies he had devoted to persecuting and killing the followers of his fellow Jewish teacher could so much better be turned towards building up communities which brought people together in a spirit of loving service. The death of Christ revealed the terrible consequence of seeing love in action and finding it such a threat to our comforts that it had to be silenced. The resurrection was the sure sign that God was at work, because no human agency could ever have transformed the void of death into a source of life. And from this, Paul developed his theology of the cross, as if the cross were the axis round which the whole created order turned, the place at which all our anger and spite are directed, and from which flows an energy which has the power to build bridges of reconciliation. Luke must also have seen this. When Christ is crucified, the first words he speaks are, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they are doing." And when he is derided and mocked, to the one criminal who recognizes his innocence, he says, "Today you will be with me in paradise." You and I look at the scene and would understand a cry of protest or a call for revenge. We see the broken body, yet we hear forgiveness and paradise. Which speaks to us the more eloquently? This gap between apparent hopelessness in human terms and the new birth which God is bringing about lies at the heart of the cross and therefore of our faith. For this is a king who gives up his life to our worst, in order that he can bring out of our lives the best. Amen.